The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
I too need to add my commendation to Charity. That was absolutely wonderful. And it steals tons of my thunder this morning. And so it is one of the peculiar ironies of history that it is often the most influential people in each epoch that tend to be forgotten, overshadowed by the ever-shifting tides of politics, ideology, and the zeitgeist. History is, after all, not what happened, but what we remember of what happened. So, for instance, Peyton Randolph was the unanimous choice to serve as the first president of the fledgling United States during the First and Second Continental Congress, but even at his home in colonial Williamsburg, the fact remains largely unacknowledged, if not altogether unknown. Ask the ordinary school child or adult in America who was the first president of the United States, and they will invariably identify some latecomer who during the first 15 years of American independence was a field commander of an army. Gouverneur Morris was the primary author of the Constitution, but his name rarely appears even in scholarly works on the American experiment in liberty. From just before World War I to just after the Vietnam conflict, Robert Moses was more powerful than any mayor of New York City or any governor of New York State. He built every bridge to and from Manhattan, except the Brooklyn Bridge. He established every park in the city, except Central Park. He engineered every expressway, every parkway, and every freeway in and out of the metropolis. Between 1917 and 1978, nothing was built in the world's largest, busiest, and greatest city without his direct involvement or endorsement. Yet today, his name is buried, while the politicians who did his bidding on history's center stage, Nelson Rockefeller, Al Smith, Fiorello LaGuardia, Thomas Dewey, and Franklin Roosevelt now stand in his place. George Meredith was the most popular English novelist of the 19th century, consistently outselling Charles Dickens. Just as Thomas Chalmers outsold Jane Austen and Sir Walter Scott combined in the generation before. Now, I've taken the opportunity at past ACCS events to glean lessons from the forgotten legacies of Peyton Randolph and Gouverneur Morris, of Robert Moses, of George Meredith, along with a host of others like Gerhard Agrota, James Stewart, Theodore Beza, and Arthur Quiller Couch. Today, I want to briefly introduce you to another forgotten great. According to biographer Andrew Hill, at the time of his death in 1900, John Ruskin was perhaps the most famous living Victorian apart from the Queen herself. He had seemingly an out-of-proportion influence on the lives and the thinking of such wildly varied personalities as G.K. Chesterton and Mahatma Gandhi, on William Morris and J.M.W. Turner, on Leo Tolstoy and Frank Lloyd Wright, on the Hudson River School painters and the founders of the Labor Party, on urban planners and environmentalists. But the succeeding century has not been kind to Ruskin. He is only vaguely known and rarely read today. More's the pity. This past summer, I stood with a group of men at the west facade of Giles Kirk in Edinburgh, Scotland. I was pointing out the various architectural details of the magnificent 9th century cathedral with its distinctive crown steeple and the oddly mismatched remnants of its 12th, 14th, and 18th century restorations. And as I described these details, I could see their eyes glazing over. I remembered that in my backpack, I actually had a print of Ruskin's watercolor of that same scene painted more than a century and a half before. With his help, I was able to show them that the stones were not plain gray, tinged with soot and grime, but instead were full of mother-of-pearl complexities, pale pinks and soft golds with silvery blue veins. For the first time, they saw it. They were looking at the cathedral, but now they saw it. For some of them, it was a revelation. One told me that he would never be able to look at a building in the same way again. According to Ruskin, that is precisely the purpose of education, to enable us to see in such a way that we can never unsee again. As he put it, that to see clearly is poetry, it's prophecy, it is theology, all in one. Education is a way of seeing. It probably should not surprise us that Ruskin, who expressed strong views about painting, architecture, literature, music, the environment, missions, sculpture, poetry, and theology, would also have strong views about education. At a time when transient progressive ideas and fashions were becoming more and more dominant, Ruskin was an articulate and unflinching advocate for what he called the lasting things, the permanent things. True education, he argued, is what enables us to discern the difference between passing fancies of the hour and the enduring treasures of the ages. It's not just a way of knowing, it's a way of seeing. Thus, he argued, the entire object of true education is to make people not merely do the right things, but to enjoy the right things. Not merely to be industrious, but to love industry. Not merely to be learned, but to love knowledge. And not merely to be pure, but to love purity. Not merely to be just, but to hunger and thirst after justice. Indeed, he asserted, reading and writing are in no sense education unless they contribute to this end. This is a truth that has been stated again and again by the wisest sages of the ages. The Prince of Preachers, Charles Haddon Spurgeon, once wrote, "I would have everybody able to read and write and cipher. Indeed, I don't think that a man can know too much, but mark you, the knowing of these things is not education. And there are millions of your reading and writing folk who are as ignorant as neighbor Norton's calf." C.S. Lewis put it this way, "Education without values, as useful as it seems, only makes man a more clever devil." And we make men without chests and expect them of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. Indeed, what generally passes for education in this poor fallen world is a dangerous thing. As Scripture declares, knowledge puffeth up. In other words, when it comes right down to it, true education must not perpetuate the pretense of simply transferring information and skills from teacher to student. It is at heart a process of discipleship of one kind or another. It is a worldview project. It is a community project. It is a way of seeing. In our very practical modern world, we tend to think that what a man or a woman does or does not believe, how he or she looks at the world, is not really all that important. We like to think that we can somehow separate private from public concerns, character from performance, worldview from responsibility. But such a notion carries with it a fearful, dreadful implication. It really means that it does not matter what any one of us believes, so long as we don't take our beliefs too terribly seriously. But throughout history, wise men and women like Ruskin have understood that far from being irrelevant, superfluous, or a private affair, our inmost faith is of utmost importance in our lives. Ideas really do have consequences. And yes, worldviews really, really, really do matter. After all, as a man thinks in his heart, so is he. How we see makes all the difference in the world. So T.S. Eliot asserted, all education is a transmission of culture, so that a dysfunctional culture can only transmit a dysfunctional education. If he is right, and the dumb certainties of experience indicate that he is, then it is vital for us to raise up a counter to the prevailing culture vision of education. It is incumbent upon us to equip and enable our sons and daughters to see in such a way as to never be able to unsee again. As Eliot concluded, it is a part of the function of education to help us escape. Not from our own time, for we are bound by that, but from the intellectual and emotional limitations of our time. The blinkered vision and blindness of our time. True education enables us to see clearly, to see with discernment, to see the difference between what is right and what is almost right, between what is good and what is best, between the straight, substantive, and certain, and the squiggly, squishy, and ambiguous. But there are dangers. Even for those of us who've caught the vision, who are besotted by the vision, who can't get enough of the vision. Now, after all, knowledge puffeth up. Here, too, Ruskin's example is instructive to us. The first half of his life, Ruskin was furiously, prodigiously productive. He started new programs for women in Winnington Hall and Somerville College. He became the Slade Professor of Fine Art at Oxford. He helped to establish the Anglia Ruskin College at Cambridge. He wrote 5 volumes of Modern Painters and his marvelous Mornings in Florence. He wrote the Seven Lamps of Architecture, the Stones of Venice in three volumes, Unto the Last, and three volumes of memoirs. In all of this feverish productivity, he was described by many as a kind of intellectual whirling dervish. And the result was is that he exhausted himself. And he lost sight of the very thing that he thought he would never be able to unsee. In the middle of his life, he came to a crisis of faith. Exhausted by his labors, he no longer cared for art, music, ideas. He described himself as tossed to and fro on waves of exhausted, disinterested doubt. And then in 1876, he met a young painter named Lilias Trotter. Lilias Trotter was exceedingly gifted, self-taught, but Ruskin could see in her genius. He actually declared that if she devoted herself to her craft, she would become the greatest painter of the age. But Lilias Trotter was interested in something far more than painting. She believed that she was called by the Lord of all grace to minister to the least and the last. She had a ministry to the prostitutes of the streets of London, encouraging them to hear the glorious call of the gospel, to come and drink from the waters of life. Ruskin thought that she was throwing her gifts away. By 1887, she had committed herself to become a missionary to Algeria, where she spent the rest of her life, the next 25 years, ministering to poor and marginalized Muslim women in a small village. She continued to paint, and she continued to correspond with Ruskin. And in that correspondence, something happened to Ruskin. He began to see again. In the correspondence between them, there is a word that continually recurs. Ruskin raises the question again and again and again. The word is equilibrium. He wrote to her, "Upon the stranger tides of doubt and despair, I suffered from a kind of moral and intellectual vertigo. Having lost all equilibrium, what I once could see so clearly, I found I could no longer see, and worse, I no longer wished to see it. In my frenzied activity, I lost my way, and I knew not why. Driven to extremes, I found I was but doing, but no longer seeing. Besotted by means, I lost sight of the ends. And looking all out of balance, I no longer saw." All of us struggle with the competing concerns of life. And those of us who have caught the marvels of the vision of education, and those of us who desire for our students, our children, our grandchildren, to actually see what we can see, we can be caught up in a frenzy of activity like Ruskin. You walk next door and you think, oh, how many books I still have to read. I've got piles and piles of them already on my nightstand, and I'm getting further and further behind with every passing day. I've got to make sure that I parse out every moment of this summer so that I can be ready for the fall. How do we juggle our obligations at work with our responsibilities at home? How do we give proportionate weight to the things that we know that we need to do and the things that we just yearn to do? How do we keep our priorities at the forefront of our daily agenda in the face of the tyranny of the urgent? How do we maintain a clear-eyed, clear-headed perspective in our fast-paced, willy-nilly, fly-by-the-seat-of-our-pants existence? Like a high-wire act, we need equilibrium. We need balance. We need balance between kindness and firmness, between waiting and praying, between working and obeying, between saving and spending, between taking in and giving out, between wanting too much and expecting too little, between warm acceptance and keen discernment, between grace and truth. As Chuck Swindoll has said, for many of us, the struggle with imbalance is not an annual conflict. It's a daily grind. Recognized as a cardinal human virtue since the earliest days of antiquity, balance, equilibrium has been lauded in fable, legend, myth, logic, rhetoric, discourse, and law throughout all of history. Called by any number of different names, moderation by Aristotle, soberness by Cicero, deliberation by Plato, temperance by Tacitus, self-control by Seneca, and poise by Plutarch. Balance was universally thought to be an essential character trait of the successful and, yes, the happy life. The truth is, that the idea of balance is what animated so many of the virtues of the ancient world. By it, heroes overcame tremendous obstacles. The innocent recompensed the guilty. The weak rose above their oppressors, while the unloved and unlovely found everlasting romance. Balance was the organizing ethic of the most prized character traits that men used in the building of Western civilization, says a literary critic, A.N. Wilson. It was the virtue that essentially enlivened the noble aspirations and ideals of men and nations, of chivalry and integrity, discretion, valor, energy, and simplicity. The Bible, too, commends us to this life of equilibrium. We're to speak the truth, but we're to speak it in love. We're to desire neither poverty nor riches. We're to embrace neither fullness nor want. We're to bear one another's burdens. We're to bear our own. Salvation is a free gift, but good deeds must necessarily accompany it. The eternal gospel is good news, but it is news of fear and judgment. We're to hate the sin, but love the sinner. We're in the world, but we're not of the world. Faith is not of works, but works is a necessary accompaniment, for faith without works is dead. Interestingly, though, the ancients who had not the gospel found that balance was often little more than a compromised life, a surly detente of pragmatic resignation. For the Romans, it was simply the conservative suppression of the wilder urges, a kind of taming of the residual barbarian impulses. For many medieval troubadours and mystics, it was an awful and indecipherable paradox, a metaphysical fulcrum upon which hinged duty. But biblical balance is altogether different, not just in degree, but in kind. It entails far more than a happy medium between virtue and vice. It's not just a dialectical synthesis of two extremes or a new age centering of the mind, will, and emotions. Instead, it is a well-rounded, wholehearted, fully integrated life rooted in an unswervingly scriptural worldview. It's the singular fruit of the incarnational faith which we hold to be true. Unlike the kind of balance once lauded in the catalog of pagan virtues, biblical balance is not dependent upon the rigors of self-imposed discipline. Neither is it the monolithic or one-dimensional discipline in its scope. It is an animated lifestyle of symmetry and stability, of equilibrium and equanimity, of imperturbability and unflappability. It is the fruitful harvest of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. The reason is simple. Biblical balance is the happy melding of devotion and action, of being and doing, of patience and passion. It is the manifestation of word and deed, faith and works, forgiveness and discipline. It is the careful integration of the inner life and the outer life. It makes quiet conviction the natural companion of strident confession. It is the life of grace and maturity and sanctification and holiness. In a day marked by its notable revolt against maturity, biblical balance is a rare commodity indeed. Extremes dominate. And oftentimes, for the best of reasons. The old joke about folks who are converted midway through their Christian lives to the doctrines of grace and the Reformed faith is that we need to lock them up in a cage for at least 2 or 3 years. The cage stage can be terrifying because we're so zealous, we overwhelm everyone. Well, truth be told, we have a cage stage in classical Christian education as well. We steamroll ourselves, our schedules, and our lives thinking that we've got to make up for all of those lost years. We've got to read all of the books. We've got to listen to all of the music. We've got to understand all of the art. And we can't. That's what Ruskin realized. Ruskin realized that he had paced himself with an inhuman pace that actually denied everything that he held to be most beautiful and most true. John Buchan once said, "Our greatest inheritance, the very foundation of our civilization, is a marvel to behold and to consider. If I tried to describe its rich legacy with utmost brevity, I should take the Latin word humanitas." He went on to say, humanitas represents, in the widest sense, the accumulated harvest of the ages, the fine flower of a long discipline of Christian thought. It is the Western mind. But what's remarkable is that by its very name, humanitas reminds us that in the midst of all of these marvels, we're called to be human. We're supposed to have lives, not just jobs. We're supposed to have families, not just schools. We're supposed to have passions and desires, not just curricula and lesson plans. This is what Ruskin somehow lost. Charles Haddon Spurgeon was bedeviled throughout his life by what he called the black dog. It was depression that would creep up on him at the moments of his greatest triumph, in the midst of his most furious and prodigious projects. And he found that in the moments that the black dog stalked him, He had to remind himself of three great truths. God has called me to have a life. God has called me to recognize seasons in my life. And God has called me to take joy in my life. Abraham Kuyper was one of the most prodigiously productive heroes of the faith. And he found in Spurgeon's prescription for the black dog the prescription for his own, what he called the creeping darkness of the dismal depression of activity. You ever felt that? You feel pressed on every side. There's so much to do. There's so many needs and so many concerns that you're tempted to forget that you're supposed to have a life. That you're supposed to recognize that there are seasons. Well, when you have young children in the home, there are 1,000 tasks to take care of, you can't do everything. You can't read everything. You can't listen to every podcast. You're never going to be able to catch up. And yes, you will never be able to read everything that Doug Wilson has written. Ever. You're supposed to take joy. One of my great theological heroes is Thomas Chalmers. He was like Spurgeon and like Ruskin. He was like Kuyper, prodigiously productive. He was able to accomplish more in his life than you can possibly imagine. More than 100 books. He discipled an entire generation of young Scots. He helped to launch the Bible Society movement, the foreign mission movement that transformed the British Empire and eventually transformed the world. He was heralded as one of the greatest preachers of the age. Spurgeon, looking back a generation later, would say he was the greatest preacher since the Apostle Paul. But he too was bedeviled by the notion that when he pushed too hard, he lost sight of the very thing that he was trying to cast a vision to others to see. He needed seasons to remind himself that the days are long, but the years are short. He needed to be reminded that he needed to recognize that the call of God on him was to have a life, to love his wife and his 5 daughters, to relish the joys of being a grandfather, to know that that his reputation would not stand based on the books that he wrote, but on the children that he raised and the men that he discipled and the people that he loved and that he walked with. If I could have any exhortation for you, it would be Spurgeon's exhortation to himself. Have a life. Yes, build a school, change the world, read the books, but make sure that you recognize that all of this comes in seasons. It's not all done at once, and be certain that God has called you not just to everlasting joy, but the overflow of joy here and now. Take delight in these moments. At the end of his life, Ruskin, writing to Lilias Trotter, the missionary who opened his eyes, said this: "Where once I took pains in instructing all others to see, I now must take pains to see again myself. Where once blinkered by my furious exercise duty, I now find I must dutifully gaze with delight upon visions of beauty and truth. Late have I come to the astonishing realization that I cannot exhort a disembodied truth. I can only teach what I am. I often tell our teachers that the best teachers are simply those who love what they love in front of those whom they love. That's the essence of classical education, isn't it? We're the beneficiaries of an extraordinary web of human relationships. We therefore need to begin to understand that classical Christian education is more about a culture than it is about a curriculum. It's more about a way of life than it is a way of doing. It's more a vision of what God's called us to than it is a simple set of mechanical prescriptives that are to be implemented in our lives. It's about accountability. It's about family. It's about community. It's about that rich covenant into which we have been grafted by God's good providence. It is, to use the marvelous phrase of Thomas Chalmers, it is the expulsive power of a new affection. An affection that so grips our heart that it pushes every other false affection out so that we can see, so that we can see clearly, and so that we can stand with those around us and say, look, those stones aren't simply gray, stained and sooted. See the mother of pearl complexities? See the streaks of pinks and the strains of blue? Do you see it? That's classical education. And that requires that we have a footing about us, that we maintain our equilibrium, that we have lives of balance. Oh, brothers and sisters, go forth from this place and change the world. But as you do, make sure you have a life. That as you do, recognize the seasons. As you do, oh, take joy and delight. That's the great lesson of classical Christian education. Christ has come that we might have life, and that more abundantly. God bless you.